UN Special Rapporteur on the negative impacts of unilateral coercive measures, visited Syria and said that the sanctions have had catastrophic effects on the lives of Syrians as the country grapples with food and medicine shortages. She also said, in the current dramatic and still deteriorating humanitarian situation, as 12 million Syrians grapple with food insecurity, I urge the immediate lifting of all unilateral sanctions that severely harm human rights and prevent any efforts for early recovery, rebuilding, and reconstruction. Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan said on Thursday that he may meet his Syrian counterpart as part of a new peace process in the wake of the country's defense ministers' meeting. An Erdogan-Assad meeting will signal the official failure of U.S. attempts to topple the Syrian government through sanctions and boycotts, as it will show that U.S. allies are no longer listening to the will of America. It will cause embarrassment for the U.S., not quite on the level of their exodus in Afghanistan, but not too far off either.
The head of the International Monetary Fund, Kristalina Georgieva, has issued a dire warning over the economic outlook in 2023, saying that this year is going to be even tougher than the year 2022. That is because the U.S., EU, and Chinese economies have slowed down. The Ukraine conflict, soaring prices, and hiked interest rates, and the rise of the COVID have contributed to the slowdown in the global economy. She also said that a third of the world economy will be hit by a recession in 2023.
For most of the world economy, this is going to be a tough year, tougher than the year we leave behind. Why? Because the three big economies, US, EU, China, are all slowing down simultaneously. Half of the European Union will be in recession next year. China is going to slow down this year further. Next year would be a tough year for China. Mm-hmm. And that translates into negative trends globally.
Back in October, the IMF slashed its outlook for global economic growth in 2023. It blamed the gloomy outlook on the ongoing conflict in Ukraine and tougher monetary policies. According to Georgieva, China will face a very difficult start to the year 2023. That's because it is likely to grow at or below global growth for the first time in 40 years, she said.
China has slowed down dramatically in 2022 because of this tight zero COVID policy. For the first time in 40 years, China's growth in 2022 is likely to be at or below global growth. That has never happened before. And looking into next year, for 3, 4, 5, 6 months, the relaxation of COVID restrictions would mean bushfire COVID cases throughout China.
She also said that the U.S. economy may avoid a recession, but warned a strong labor market there may lead the U.S. Federal Reserve to keep interest rates tight so as to combat high inflation, which could have negative economic consequences of its own. The IMF warning comes amid similar predictions by other institutions. UK-based Centre for Economics and Business Research has said that the global slide into a recession next year, as a number of economies will contract due to surging borrowing costs introduced to combat inflation. K. Daniel Neufeld said, "We expect central bankers to stick to their guns in 2023, despite the economic costs. The cost of bringing inflation down to more comfortable levels is a poorer growth outlook for a number of years to come." The report is more pessimistic than the most recent forecast by the International Monetary Fund. Meanwhile, oil prices continue to slide, weighed down by China's rising COVID cases and a recession warning from the IMF. The warning comes amid a worsening economic crisis in developed nations. Just recently, Germany's Federal Statistical Office said that the country is grappling with its highest annual inflation in more than 70 years. According to official data, full-year inflation reached 7.9% in 2022 amid surging energy and food prices. The last time annual inflation was near that level was in the year 1951, when it stood at 7.6% as the post-war economic boom began. And the UK faces one of the worst recessions among the world's leading industrialized nations this year.
We're not the government. We haven't been in power for 12 years. right, every aspect of society that's been impacted by government policy. 10 years of austerity, cuts to the economy, slowing growth, a badly handled Brexit, whatever your view on Brexit was, right, has all led to where we are today. But the fact that we've got so many people out on strike and so many people suffering, only the government can change it, or a change of government can change it.
The fallout from spiraling inflation triggered by the pandemic and the Ukraine conflict will persist for longer in the UK than in other G7 nations, and the country's recovery will be one of the weakest.
In November 2022, the Republican Party won the majority of votes to the House of Representatives. They vowed to go after Democrats and President Joe Biden, but now cracks have appeared with the party itself. In a historic incident, the GOP failed to nominate the House Speaker. Party leader Kevin McCarthy got just 203 votes in two rounds, less even than Democrat Hakeem Jeffries in the GOP-controlled chamber, and fared even worse, with 202 votes in round three. It went to six rounds, but yet McCarthy could not gain the votes. It was a tumultuous start to the new Congress and pointed to a difficult road ahead with Republicans now in control of the House. A new generation of conservative Republicans, many aligned with Donald Trump's Make America Great Again agenda, want to upend business as usual in Washington and were committed to stopping McCarthy's rise without concessions to their priorities. It is widely believed that a revolt of ultra-hardliners has dealt a humiliation to McCarthy.
Those of us who will not be voting for Kevin McCarthy today take no joy in this discomfort that this moment has brought. But if you want to drain the swamp, you cannot put the biggest alligator in charge of the exercise.
McCarthy became the first candidate to fall short in a first ballot for Speaker in a century. The impasse means Republicans are unable even to assume the control that they won in the midterms, as a new House can't yet be sworn in. The standoff over McCarthy has been building since Republicans appeared on track to win the House majority in the midterm elections in November. A new generation of Trump-aligned Republicans led the opposition to McCarthy, believing that he's neither conservative enough nor tough enough to battle Democrats.
And they even came to the position where one, Matt Gaetz, said, I don't care if we go to plurality and we elect Hakeem Jeffries and it hurts the new frontline members not to get reelected. Well, that's not about America, and I will always fight to put the American people first, not a few individuals that want something for themselves. So we may have a battle on the floor, but the battle is for the conference and the country, and that's fine with me.
While the Senate remains in Democratic hands, House Republicans are eager to confront Biden after 2 years of the Democrats controlling both houses of Congress. But disagreements to choose the House Speaker is an ominous sign for the party and its conservative agenda. Even if McCarthy succeeds to be the Speaker, he'll be a weak figure who may be in office but barely in power. The war, which started with the Tea Party backlash to the Obama administration, is far from over.
We will compromise, but we will not capitulate. And there's a very serious difference. There's 222 Republicans in our conference now. So if 20 people are able to drive this train however they want to, 202 of us might as well go home, because that means they are the conference. That means those 20 people will be the majority. Well, that is capitulation, and we will not do that. Compromise, yes.
The fractured support for McCarthy is over the direction of the GOP between swing and district moderates and conservatives who have taken up the populist agenda of the former President Donald Trump. It is not believed that the chaos highlights the dilemma facing House Republicans.
You have 20 people demanding that 201 surrender to them unconditionally. Well, I will not surrender unconditionally. If you have conditions, give them to us. We'll consider them. Doesn't mean we'll do them, but you have to talk about them. But we've asked, what is it you want? What do you need? But you have 20 people demanding the unconditional surrender of, including this group of warriors. We will not unconditionally surrender. Tell us what you want. We might surrender if you tell us the terms.
Analysts say no matter the concessions made to some of those on the far right, they simply will not relent and join other Republicans. The crisis is even more poignant as the party is set to brace for the presidential election set to be held in 2024. It now appears the fractures that Trump created within the Republican Party are deeper than ever before. With Trump still desperate to be elected president, it is unlikely the GOP will be able to unite behind another leader and change its electoral fortunes anytime soon.
وقضى ربك ألا تعبدوا إلا إياه وبالوالدين إحسانا.
Your Lord has decreed that you shall not worship anyone except Him, and He has enjoined kindness to parents.
For humanity.
Sayyid Abdullah Al-Musawi.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. Brothers and sisters, dear listeners, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, and welcome to IRIB English Radio, and you are listening to the program For Humanity. One of the key concepts of a humanity, or the human being in general, is to preserve his dignity and to preserve his essence, because we said, you know, what makes a human person or human being a human or a person is the fact that he preserves his dignity and everything else around it, all the other rights, all other human rights, are in fact trying to preserve that human dignity. We understand that the human being has two dimensions. He has a materialistic dimension and he has a spiritual dimension. And we can submit to the fact that human being, or the human being himself, is a very complicated creature. Absolutely complicated. So it is very hard to judge such a creature with certainty. And from here we can understand why people of theology or philosophy or those who are trying to put laws, they never got it right. Or they always keep, you know, having this moral dilemma. Where should we do this and should we do that? If we do this, what happens to that? There's constant trouble or constant, you know, fight within those who are trying to, you know, write the laws for mankind. So one of the things that we ask in regards to the human dignity, and obviously his basic right, is when we look at punishments, or as we call them in Islam, retributions, iqab, or qisas, to be precise. Are those punishments suitable for the human being? In a way, it does not override or violates his dignity. Be it retribution, Islamic retribution, or be it, you know, punishment by the law. And what is the relationship between punishment and retribution and the human dignity? When we look at the human-made systems that we have today, and that we most, if not actually all, I should all say, all governments are bound by, we see them when it comes to the concept of punishment and the human dignity, we see them colliding. In a sense where there are a lot of punishment written by man that actually takes the right of a person and they are not befitting for him. Such laws, I mean, I could sit here for days and days trying to go through the unfair, unjust laws that human beings have to face as a punishment for actions or acts that it does not fit the crime, does not fit the punishment, or the punishment does not fit the crime, which in fact ends up doing what? Taking the human dignity away, or trying to at least attack that human dignity. When we look at the human being, we have to make sure that we come up with a punishment suitable for him. And the question is, who can come up with a law that is suitable with the human being in a sense or in a way where it does not collide with his human dignity, where it does not take his rights away? I mean, not a person that does something really stupid and then he ends up being imprisoned for many years or at least punished for something that's, you know, ridiculous. Let us take a short break and then we will look at that.
Dear listeners, you are listening to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. You can send us your emails, comments, and questions at englishradio@irib.ir.
Welcome back, brothers and sisters, and you are listening to the program For Humanity coming to you from IRIB English Radio. We were talking about punishment and human dignity. We said who can come up with a law or a punishment or retribution that is suitable for the human being. In a way, it does not take or deprive him of his dignity. And the short answer is obviously Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Since we said human beings are very complicated humans and they're very special in their own way and they're very unique. So the one that needs to put a system of punishment or retribution, it has to be the maker himself. Why? Because the maker himself, he knows those human beings because he created them. Therefore, he knows what's good for them, what's bad for them. And when he places retributions, he knows that this is fitting for them or not fitting for them. It will hurt them or their dignity or not hurt them, right? So, obviously, it's God's law. And God's law today is summarized in one word, and that is Islam. When we look at the Islamic retributions, we see it does not collide with the human dignity, unlike the man-made laws. Because Islam takes everything into perspective. For example, to make it much easier, much understandable. In a system, or at least in a country, where there's poverty, if a person tries to, I don't know, steal a loaf of bread to feed his family, he will be caught by the police and he will be labeled as a thief and he might be imprisoned for trying to survive. In an Islamic world, or in a world where it is governed by an Islamic law, they don't do that. We don't label him as a thief. We look at the circumstances. Why did the person have to do what he has to do? Is it out of need? Out of necessity, out of survival, or not, then the retribution or punishment comes into play. Sometimes you'll find out in Islamic laws that the society should be punished, not the person, because the person is only in the state that he's in, and he committed what he committed because the society neglected his rights. So we see, for example, Amir al-Mu'minin alayhi salam, and other imams, as I've read in their stories, that when they look at workers, they said, have they been paid up front? Have their wages been set for them? Did you pay them? And sometimes they say, no, we will pay them later. He says, no, you shouldn't do that. You should give them their money up front. Because it's trying to preserve that human dignity, not take it away. So here is a dilemma that we fall in, that these laws that we have, they're always colliding with the human dignity. In Islam, I mean, the harshest punishment that we have is death. And death is only when a person violates the rights of other people. by taking either their life or doing something that takes their dignity, for example, committing adultery, a married man or a married woman with one another. When a person's dignity and a person's right is being taken, then Allah says, you are no longer deserving of having yours. Therefore, we need to take it away. So only Islam can preserve the human rights and human dignity through the laws that he places when it comes to punishment and retributions. Thank you for listening. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa alihi. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa alihi. A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
A new study has found that in Britain, people with disabilities are more likely to cut back on energy use and food. Experts had earlier warned about the dire situation in Britain during winter, so in this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for more. Guardian wrote in this regard, disabled people in the UK are much more likely to struggle to heat their homes and cut back on food this winter, according to a report highlighting massive income gaps amid the cost of living squeeze. Research from the Resolution Foundation found people with disabilities had an available amount to spend that was about 44% lower than that of other working-age adults, exposing them hugely to the rising cost of essentials. The think tank said there was a chasm between the underlying disposable incomes of people with a disability and the non-disabled population, according to an analysis of official figures and a YouGov survey of just under 8,000 working-age adults, more than 2,000 of whom reported a long-term illness of disability, highlighting the risks to households struggling with the highest rates of inflation since the early 1980s. It said almost half, that is 48%, of disabled adults said they had to cut back on energy use this winter, compared with almost one-third of people without a disability. Up to two-fifths of people with a disability, 41%, said they could not afford to keep their homes warm, compared with 23% of the non-disabled population. People with a disability are far more likely to be poorer than the rest of the population, with up to a third of adults in the lowest income households having a disability, compared with less than a tenth of those in the richest homes. The Resolution Foundation said the income gaps were only partly explained by lower employment rates among disabled workers. Even after accounting for employment status, more than half of the original income gaps remain, showing that in-work disabled people face an increased risk of being on lower incomes than their peers. Charlie McCurdy, an economist at the Resolution Foundation, said that while fast-rising prices for essentials were affecting people across the UK, people with disabilities were more exposed to the most severe effects. This means people with a disability, who account for a third of the poorest households in Britain, will require additional protection during the cost-of-living crisis, which the government has acknowledged through their cost-of-living payments, he said. But more policy work will be needed, not just through this crisis, but to make more progress on closing the huge income gaps that already existed between disabled people and the rest of the population. Also, ABC had an eye on this issue, saying while much of the world anxiously waits to see if their economies will tip into a recession next year, the UK may already be in the midst of one. The economy shrank 0.3% between July and September in what Bank of England forecasts say is the start of a prolonged period of negative growth that will last throughout 2023. Part of the problem is inflation, which is at 10.7% and providing persistent feeding through into higher prices for food and housing and demands for higher wages. The cost of living squeeze is being felt all over the world as central banks attempt to tackle spiraling prices with interest rate rises designed to make people spend less. Pent-up demand from the pandemic, global supply shocks from COVID-19, and the Russia-Ukraine crisis have created a complex economic situation. As policymakers attempt to pull the right levers to get the economy back on track, they risk overdoing it, causing consumption to taper off and creating the perfect conditions for a recession. Many predict much of the world will be in such a scenario by next year, and the UK could already be leading the way. Why is Britain set to be the first country into recession and the last country out? Labour leader Keir Starmer asked in Parliament last month. The question followed an OECD report that revealed Britain would plunge to the bottom of the table of G7 leading industrial nations for economic growth over the next 2 years. It also comes amid tough assessments from some economists about the UK's current economic outlook.
This is the show A to Z. For today's program, Brother Muhammad is going to talk to us about Islamic education. Stay tuned.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. In today's discussion with regards to Islamic education, we would like to focus on Salah. Salah, which is an important act of worship in Islam, And one of the most important acts of showing obedience to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, it's not only an act of showing obedience, rather it's an act of showing love to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. It is an act through which we connect with Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala by first and foremost humbling ourselves before the Almighty Allah. One of the ways that we're told, and when it comes to Islamic education of salah, nurturing it into the lives of our children, we find as parents we need to be on the lookout for constantly reminding our children towards salah. And verbal reminders are one way to do so. Within these reminders, we're also recommended to encourage our children to learn the mustahab nawafil prayers, the supererogatory prayers that are the extra prayers besides the five daily prayers. So as we know, the nawafil, which are 34 units of prayer, alongside the 17 units of wajib prayer, are considered to be the signs of a mu'min. A believer is somebody who recites 51 rak'ats, or units of prayer, every single day. So when we look at the traditions, we're told that the imams would actually encourage the youths in their young age as well to pray the supererogatory prayers, the nawafil, such that we know from the different traditions that these prayers are the supplements to our regular prayer. If our regular prayer has some deficiencies, which it does surely, and if it's not accepted in Allah's presence, then indeed these nawafil prayers are present to rectify those limitations of our five daily prayers. And that is something that we also need to pray ourselves and encourage our children likewise to pray the nawafil prayers. Now, just as a quick brief on the nawafil prayers, the 34 rakats of the nawafil, first and foremost, and the most important of all of them, is 11 units of the night prayer, Salat al-Layl. And indeed, those are 8 rakats on its own, just like a normal 2 rakat unit on their own, 4 times. And the last 3 are called the Shafa and the Watr prayer, the 2 rakats of Shafa, which are likewise just like the Fajr Salah, but without the Qunut. And in the first rak'ah, we recite Surah An-Nas, and in the second, Surah Al-Falaq. And the 1 rak'ah prayer, which is indeed a special prayer, that's the only 1 rak'ah prayer that we have besides Salat Al-Ihtiyat. This Watr prayer is special. Inshallah, I would recommend you to look at books of prayer like Mafatihul Jinan or other books that have this Salat Al-Layl, especially the Salat Al-Watr mentioned there. It's a very important part of Salat Al-Layl, and it's encouraged that if one cannot pray the whole 11 rak'ats, one should at least pray this 1 rak'at at least at night. Besides that, for Fajr Salat, there are 2 rak'ats of Nawafil before Fajr Salah. For Zohr and Asr Salat as well, there are 8 rak'ats each before each of them. So this makes in total 2 for Fajr, 8 for Zohr, 8 for Asr, which is 18 rak'ats right there. With the 11 rak'ats of Salat al-Layl, makes it 29 rak'ats. And the remaining 5 are actually allocated to the Maghrib and Isha Salah. 4 rak'ats after Salat al-Maghrib and 1 rak'at after Salat al-Isha. And this 1 rak'at is actually 2 rak'ats sitting down, which counts for 1 rak'at standing. Indeed, these all prayers called nawafil are very important aspects of the worship of a Muslim, and one needs to take them seriously and try and implement them slowly and gradually in our lives, such that we take at least 1 prayer and we pray its nawafil every day, and then slowly and gradually, once it becomes a habit, we add more, and we inshallah try to become somebody who has the sign of a true mu'min of praying 51 rak'ah salah. I hope you enjoyed today's discussion. Until next time, fi amanillah, under God's protection. Thank you.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parstoday.ir.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
In the limelight.
Whenever there is a show of solidarity with Palestine or blasting the Zionist regime's attacks against Palestinians in any corner in the world, Western regimes try to label it as anti-Semitism. Multiple U.S. cities have adopted a definition of anti-Semitism that silences Palestinians and expands surveillance. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for more. The website of Truthout noted, in multiple cities across the U.S., the right-wing push for new laws to silence criticism of the Zionist regime for its human rights violations has reached a crescendo. As part of a growing international effort, the Zionist regime lobby groups have convinced local jurisdictions in several U.S. states to adopt the controversial and overbroad definition of anti-Semitism used by the International Remembrance Alliance, IHRA, which classifies virtually all expression in support of Palestinian rights as anti-Jewish. In California, the West Hollywood, Manhattan Beach, and Los Angeles City Councils each adopted the IHRA definition in the last 2 months. In Maryland, the Montgomery County Council did the same on November 2nd. The adoption of the IHRA definition comes amid recent high-profile incidents of anti-Semitism, namely Kanye West's incendiary comments about Jewish people and former President Trump hosting outspoken white nationalist Nick Fuentes at his Mar-a-Lago estate just a week after announcing his 2024 run. Indeed, those in Montgomery County who voiced support for that definition reference West's hateful comments as an example of why it needed to be enshrined as policy. However, while purporting to combat anti-Semitism, the IHRA definition is primarily designed to shield the fabricated regime of Israel, or the Zionist entity, from criticism and ultimately from efforts towards BDS, that is boycott, divestment, sanctions movement. 7 of the IHRA definition's 11 contemporary examples of anti-Semitism focus on the Zionist regime, conflating the Israeli regime with Judaism as a whole. Among them are applying double standards to the Zionist regime, or claiming that Israel is a racist endeavor. Israeli lobby groups are weaponizing the IHRA definition to punish and threaten constitutionally protected speech, in particular that of Palestinians, describing the Zionist regime's brutal military rule and denial of Palestinian freedom. Even the lead drafter of the IHRA definition, Kenneth Stern, has argued against its use in legislation or policy, stating that it serves as an attack on academic freedom and free speech. When adopted by municipalities, the IHRA definition expands the scope of policing by giving law enforcement yet another tool and pretense to surveil communities who speak out for Palestinian rights. For instance, when West Hollywood officials adopted the IHRA definition, they claimed that it serves as an important tool for law enforcement to identify, measure, monitor, and ultimately combat anti-Semitism, much like the post-9/11 counter-terror surveillance programs that devastated Muslim, Arab, Black, and South Asian immigrant communities in the name of national security. Will the IHRA definition measure public safety in terms of how many people that law enforcement can censor, surveil, and wrongfully criminalize? For decades, the fabricated regime of Israel, the Zionist entity, has faced increasing international condemnation for its racial discrimination and violent displacement of Palestinians. International watchdogs Amnesty International and Human Rights Watch have both released reports accusing the Zionist regime of committing apartheid. Now, the IHRA definition is attempting to smear those criticisms themselves as racist. Black and brown activists challenging racist surveillance by the Los Angeles Police Department, LAPD, recognize the irony of this development. Akhil Gopal, a member of the Stop LAPD Spying Coalition based in Skid Row neighborhood of downtown Los Angeles, compares the logic of the IHRA definition to similar legislation that criminalizes predominantly Black communities for criticizing police violence. The IHRA definition mirrors Blue Lives Matter bills, which treat law enforcement as a marginalized class. It is part of an effort to embed pro-Israel advocates within legal anti-discrimination, civil rights, and hate crime infrastructures as a supposedly marginalized identity in order to weaponize the language of hate and extremism against Palestinians. Gopal told Truth Out, when the IHRA definition is adopted by municipalities, it encourages law enforcement to surveil communities for supposed infractions. As a coalition, we have been organizing to expose how surveillance is not just an invasion of privacy, but an inherent part of criminalization. According to research attained by Stop LAPD Spying, at least one academic paper funded by the Department of Homeland Security has already suggested using the IHRA definition as an indicator of extremism in its widely denounced federal surveillance program, Countering Violent Extremism. Community organizations, civil liberties groups, and policy experts have fiercely opposed CVE since it was launched, citing the ways in which the program criminalizes constitutionally protected speech, religious practices, and political activism. The adoption of the definition by DHS would be a dangerous expansion and continuation of the war on terror's devastating impact on Muslim and immigrant communities across the U.S. Celine Cassini, a member of the Palestinian Youth Movement, PYM, in Los Angeles, explains that she has worked with the Stopped LAPD Spying, Black Alliance for Just Immigration, Vigilant Love, and other community organizations to oppose CVE, which racially profile communities and deputizes mental health providers, teachers, and other service providers to report community members to law enforcement under false pretenses of extremism. If the IHRA definition were to be incorporated into CVE, we can expect an increase of reports accusing pro-Palestine speech and activism as extremists, she said. This is not only an attempt to intimidate our communities and allies from building power through local organizing, but to also restrain free speech, consequently diminishing the health of our communities. Palestine Legal, a civil rights organization dedicated to providing legal support to the movement for Palestinian rights, has recently discovered through public records requests that pro-Israel organizations have sent PYMs, flyers, and materials to law enforcement, asking that Cassini's organization be put under police surveillance and shut down. The attempts to push the IHRA definition into law are just the latest example of the long-standing right-wing effort to redefine anti-Semitism as characterized primarily by criticism of the Zionist regime, rather than as an interconnected element of white supremacy and all forms of racial bigotry. Roughly half of the incidents of suppression Palestine Legal response to each year include false accusations of anti-Semitism, totaling 1,017 incidents from 2014 to 2021. The adoption of the IHRA definition in multiple cities is not only dangerous, but also surprisingly regressive considering the broad array of institutions that have rejected it. Both Palestinian and Jewish human rights organizations, as well as major newspaper editorial boards, have opposed codifying the IHRA definition of anti-Semitism into law, including the ACLU, the National Lawyers Guild, the Center for Constitutional Rights, Palestine Legal, Jewish Voice for Peace, the New York Times, the Los Angeles Times, and the Washington Post. Cassini and Gopal's organizations continue to resist the IHRA definition and hope community opposition will prevent it from continuing to spread across the U.S. and beyond.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Assalamu alaykum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
Hame ba wujood ghudde saratani Israel mukhalifin.
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel.
Wajh mushtarak hame wahdat ummat islami.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Islamia!
If you strive in the cause of God, victory will definitely follow. The following is a part of the speech delivered on June 28, 2022 by Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, in a meeting with the head of the judiciary branch and a number of top officials and employees of the judiciary.
I have heard people say that we do not have a law about this. First of all, the existing laws can be used for this, and based on these laws, the related ruling can be reached. But if you do not have a law for a certain situation, quickly make a law. These are important things and is among very important issues. Of course, sometimes the judiciary itself is the source of some of the news. Sometimes a member of the judiciary mentions something about a people. Sometimes a member of the judiciary mentions something about a person or about an organization, and his statements affect public opinion. The last thing I would like to recommend is for you to follow up on the files you open and to finish them. Finish the various cases involving public affairs that the judiciary has started. For example, about some factories, some illegal seizures, and the like. You shouldn't open a wound and leave it untreated. Of course, there is usually a big commotion in the beginning when something like this is being done. Then it is slowly forgotten. Whatever you start, whatever issue it is, he mentioned central issues. Central issues are very good. Especially pursue them because of their priority. Finish the matter and complete the case. Then you can move aside.
دنیای اسلام یک نسخه امروز دارد و اون اتحاد.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
Your work is hard, truly hard. Indeed, the work of the judiciary is one of the jobs that is very difficult. I have been in the ongoing executive affairs of the revolution since the beginning of the revolution. I have always said that I am afraid of accepting to be in charge of matters related to the judiciary branch. And I have avoided doing so because this is a very difficult job and it is very demanding. You have taken on much work on yourselves. Well, the reward for this is just as much. That is, in proportion to the amount of the work that is done. The divine reward that is given is also just as much, God willing. Follow up on the work that is being done for the sake of God. Follow up on work while benefiting from divine guidance. God willing, you will be given the divine reward. You may do a good action at times and no one realizes it, not even your manager or your boss. Your subordinates may not understand what you have done either. For example, you may have worked a few hours overtime, or maybe you did a job carefully, or perhaps you fought diligently against corruption and dishonesty. No one may realize what you have done, but God's scribes realize.
Allah, I wanna thank you. I wanna thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pereza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
Allah!
braving the bone-chilling weather, mourners are remembering those who gave their lives for the future of this region and beyond.
These people gathered here to pay tribute to martyrs to the war against the key terrorist groups in the region who were backed by the U.S.
General Qasem Soleimani was remembered as a hero for humanity, who transcended geographical and ethnic boundaries, and whose campaign against the Daesh terrorist groups saved every Muslim and non-Muslim country, including Pakistan.
Shahid Qasem Soleimani.
Mati Qasem Soleimani is a way of life and a school of thought to fight the enemies of the Muslim world and the East. If the world of Islam and countries in the East want to save themselves from the malicious designs of the West, aimed at breaking this region into pieces to create its new world order, then they have to follow Qasem Soleimani and the strategies he used to save the West Asia region from the collapse.
Speakers at the gathering shed light on different dimensions of martyr Soleimani's life and his legacy, as well as how it impacted the region.
The U.S. and its Western allies had remained helpless and in despair in the face of global terrorism. Martyr Qasem Soleimani put an end to the darkness of this hopelessness vis-a-vis U.S.-backed Takfiri terrorism.
Some 70,000 Pakistani citizens have been killed at the hands of U.S.-backed Takfiri terrorists, including in attacks on schools and children. These were the same terrorists that General Soleimani took out in an anti-terror campaign for which he will always be remembered. Mohammed Turi, Karachi.
The two-year anniversary of the election integrity protest, which burst into Congress on January 6, 2020, has been overshadowed by Congress's historic failure to select the third most important post in the country, the Speaker of the House of Representatives. After more than a dozen votes, mainstream Republican Kevin McCarthy finally won a majority, ending the total paralysis of the new Congress. However, the embarrassing stalemate was the worst of its kind since before the American Civil War.
Both of them just show how American politics is dominated by spectacle and political theater, while Americans who are suffering through a terrible economic hardship right now and are politically polarized are just sitting on the sidelines while all this plays out.
As the speaker chaos continued, Democrats demanded attention for 2020, while Republican lawmakers largely ignored the anniversary. The stark difference isn't surprising. Polls have long shown that 35% of the country still calls the events of January 6th a legitimate protest, while 50% still calls it an insurrection. The subsequent January 6th committee to investigate the incident was either branded a political show trial and witch hunt or a necessary defense of American-style democracy.
It should have been a bipartisan inquiry, a serious one, into what was, you know, supposedly this, you know, vast constitutional violation by Trump and his campaign and his administration, and it's just become this endless commercial for the Democratic Party, which is totally bankrupt. And 2 years later, they're still using it to, you know, try and get themselves elected.
While Washington is repeatedly faulted for encouraging protests in other countries, almost 200 January 6th protesters have been sentenced to prison terms. Seemingly every participant has been publicly hunted down, which may serve as a chilling effect which forestalls future protests. Has Washington's response to the controversial events of January 6, 2020 reduced conflict, division, and disunity? We cannot ask Congress because just like 2 years ago, they cannot meet in peace. Ramin Mazahiri, Chicago.
It's afternoon, and many Rohingya women are waiting in a queue to receive blankets offered by an NGO. Some are angry since they haven't received any blankets yet. Over the last few days, northern India has had freezing weather, and that has heaped misery of homelessness for the refugees living in makeshift tents. Zahid Hussain has come out of his shanty